And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday morning. It's September 10th. 49 degrees currently in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. We've got 43 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at mostly sunny skies, turning to partly sunny skies as we go throughout the afternoon hours. Temperatures climbing into the upper 70s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Friday, we're looking at a mixture of clouds and sunshine. So we'll call it partly cloudy skies to broken clouds. Temperatures will climb into the mid to upper 70s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the low to mid 80s in the Heber Valley. There will be a slight chance of a pop-up shower or storm, although I think most of the moisture stays south on your Friday. As we move into Saturday, we'll call it partly cloudy skies as well. Temperatures warming up into the low 80s in Park City. We'll be in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. You'll notice those winds picking up out of the south and west, gusting over 40 miles per hour at times as that cold front begins to move in ahead of it. That'll get those temperatures into the 80s in both Park City and in the Heber Valley, but also could bring another chance of an isolated shower or storm. Again, not a big chance, a slight chance, but the chance will be there. Otherwise, let's move into your Sunday. Look for partly cloudy skies, windy conditions, and cooler conditions as that cooler air begins to flow in behind the front. We're talking highs in Park City going from the low 80s on Saturday to highs only in the upper 60s by the time we get towards your Sunday. In the Heber Valley, we're looking at temperatures going from highs in the upper 80s on your Saturday to highs only in the mid-70s by the time we make our way into your Sunday, with those morning lows dipping into the 50s by Sunday morning, a slight chance of a spotty shower continues into your Sunday. Now, heading into your Monday, Monday morning will be the coolest start of the day as we're looking at temperatures dipping down into the upper 30s and low 40s for both Park City and into the Heber Valley. We'll warm up only into the upper 60s again in Park City Monday afternoon, highs only in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. We're back near 80, though, as we head towards your Tuesday and Wednesday in the Heber Valley, with temperatures back in the low 70s in Park City. That's a good latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County historian Sandra Morrison. She'll be telling us more about an upcoming lecture Saturday at the historic Echo Church. Then U.S. ski team downhill skier Lauren Masuga in studio to talk about her return to sport after a season-ending injury a year ago. And from Park City School District, the Executive Director of Teaching and Learning, Amy Jenkins, is joined by Finance Coordinator and Eccles Center Director, Brett Hughes, and Kimball Arts Center Education Director, Heather Staminoff. We'll be talking about the new Arts Integration Program coordinated with the School District and Kimball Arts Center. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include Colin Domnauer, a PhD candidate in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Utah, telling more about his research into a newly identified species of psychoactive mushrooms rumored to trigger vivid hallucinations of little people, referred to as Lilliputian hallucinations. Then Amos Winter, MIT professor and author of Global by Design, on how to create innovations at scale, travel, and transform, explores how smart innovations can solve urgent challenges in developing regions around the world. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, of course, heard every Thursday from 9 to 10. Taking a look at some news now. About a third of the residents of Independence, including the former mayor, want to dissolve their Wasatch County town. Their effort comes amid development discussions that could transform the northern end of town. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
23 of the 75 registered voters in the town of Independence want to disincorporate, to give up their status as a town. Phil Sweat is among them. He says he and his neighbors are concerned about future development plans. They don't want the small town southeast of Heber to become another Park City.
Well, I just don't want to see that type of an atmosphere in this farm community. And it's still a country, you know, it's still a country community.
Sweat served as mayor for 17 years, but in 2025, he resigned mid-meeting because he was concerned about the rest of the town council's stance on future development. At the time, the town administrator was in early talks with three developers about plans that could include an RV park, a new road, a town center, and new homes. Meeting minutes from August 2025 indicate Sweat wanted to revise the general plan to curtail higher density or heavily commercial growth on the town's north edge, but the council didn't agree with him. Sweat also felt that landowners along Center Creek Road near the future town center weren't receiving enough information about the proposals.
They weren't letting anybody know what was going on, and I just finally got fed up with it and resigned and said, you guys got to find another mayor because I'm not going to sit here and try to tell the people in Center Creek this is best for them when they don't even have any say.
Town Administrator Jody Hoffman says no development applications have been submitted for the projects. At a town council meeting August 19th, she said the general plan is strict about any development.
There were 108 people when we incorporated 18 years ago. We've allowed 5 new homes in the last 18 years.
She says the general plan will also ensure any development proposals in and around the town center are executed with care.
It's encouraged property owners that own about 2,500 acres to work together to make certain that the roads go where they should go and that the infrastructure goes where it should go and that essentially all the traffic gets funneled away from the residents, the current residents, and that they develop in a way that doesn't cause an increase in property taxes.
Sweat and 22 of his neighbors submitted a petition for disincorporation in late July, asking a fourth district judge to put the issue to a vote. Meanwhile, town council members plan to campaign against it. Mayor Pro Tem Bonnie Wilson said at the August meeting she will send out postcards explaining the drawbacks.
Without the town, local residents would have no control over the development of thousands of acres of private land that is within the town boundary. Development decisions would be made by Wasatch County.
Sweat says there could still be growth if the town disbands, but he's not interested in any major commercial development in the community. Unified Independence, a developer that owns about 1,500 acres of land in the town, has asked to intervene in the court process. In a filing August 19th, it said disincorporation could negatively affect its property rights, municipal services, zoning protections, and governance interests. The judge has not responded to the developer's request. As of September 9th, the judge was waiting for confirmation that the disincorporation group had paid the required filing fee. Only then will she decide whether the effort can go forward. If the petition meets all the requirements, the judge will set a special election to determine the town's future. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The board of the historic Echo Church invites all to a lecture this weekend, and in studio with details, I have Summit County historian Sandra Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Okay, so when and where is this happening?
So this is our last talk for the summer, and it's Saturday, September 12th, so this Saturday at 4 o'clock.
Okay, and tell people how they can get to the Echo Church.
Yes, so it's about 30 minutes from Park City. Take I-80 heading east, and right after the interchange with Interstate 80 and 84 that takes you up to Ogden, there is an exit, 169. And get off at that exit and go left underneath the freeway and then skirt around the cliffs, the Red Rock Cliffs. You know you're in Echo Canyon because there's cliffs. And as you come into the town, we do have a little A-frame sign that shows you where Temple Lane is, and the church is at the top of Temple Lane, tucked in against the Red Rock Cliffs.
Okay. The title of the lecture is From Field Sketch to Photograph, An Illustrative Journey of Echo Canyon. Who's presenting?
So we are lucky enough to have Rare Books librarian Luba Basin from the Marriott Library at the University of Utah. She's going to explore the fact that Echo Canyon has been sketched, mapped, photographed, and described by generations of travelers. And so on Saturday, using the special collections and the rare books at the library, Luba will use them to demonstrate how the landscape has been transformed into an enduring image of travel in the canyon. So first-hand accounts, basically, that will show how the people that traveled through it, from pioneers and explorers until and then up until basically became a railroad and tourist destination.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's really part lecture, part slideshow, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Luba came two summers ago and talked about Lansford Hastings and his infamous 1846 publication, The Immigrant's Guide to Oregon and California. And she brought the copy that's in the Rare Books collection for everybody. We all had to put our white gloves on, but we could all get to touch it and read it and see it. So she's going to, again, she's planning to bring some of the collection from the Rare Books. And I'm assuming she hasn't, it's a surprise at this point, but I'm assuming it's going to be examples of, you know, original sketches that they have in the collection and then early photography. There was, the sketches, Captain Albert Tracy, who came with Johnson's army for the Utah War back in 1857-58, was a tremendous artist, and his journal is just full of a lot of sketches. And of course, Echo Canyon is just, after you've come across Wyoming, to suddenly drop into this canyon of these stunning red rock landscape, a lot of sketches and paintings as well. And another traveler was George Ossinger. He actually had a really interesting career, starting off whaling and then ended up in California at the Gold Rush. But he studied at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts and in 1861 joined the LDS Church and walked across the plains. So he painted and then later learned the art of photography and came back as a traveling photographer. And at that time, especially during the Civil War, photography developed considerably, a lot of photographic images. But you have to remember, this is all glass plate negatives, you know, in wagons. So incredibly challenging, and everything was being developed on site in these custom-made wagons. And then when a railroad came through in the 1860s, 1869, it met in northern Utah. And, of course, two other photographers, you know, photographed that, and, you know, A.J. Russell, who's very famous, and then C.R. Savage, who was another Salt Lake photographer, traveling photographer, so... I'm assuming she's going to bring originals of those as well.
Okay. So all these images then live down at the University of Utah?
Yeah. In fact, the Rare Books Library currently has a collection of 80,000 items. Yeah. And it goes back to actually the University of Deseret and the Utah Territorial Library. So this is, you know, all before Utah became a state in the 1890s. And that all has, as, you know, the university has developed, have you know, been consolidated into the Rare Books Library, yeah.
Yeah, so do you see this as more of a kind of an arts lecture or kind of more of a factual, historic lecture?
I think it's going to be both, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. But just, you know, just the technology, so, you know, as well. But yeah, you know, these guys, you know, were artists. So, and most of them originally, you know, were painting and sketching before they took up photography.
Okay, and you said this is the last of the lectures. You had some others earlier this season,
right? And this will be the last day that the Echo Church is open. The doors will open at 2:30, and we have two exhibitions that people might like to come and explore. So we've been celebrating the 150th anniversary of the historic Echo Church. It was built in 1876, and it's the second oldest landmark in Summit County, the oldest church. And so the first exhibit is one I put together about the humble beginnings in 1876 of the church and how it was a local non-Mormon church with a unique role that during the week, that was where kids went to school. Yeah. So it went from educating the community of children, and then the exhibit explores, you know, its abandonment, and it was threatened with demolition in the 1970s, and basically, you know, saved by the local townspeople, which as you get to Echo, you will notice there are not very many of them.
I was going to say, I mean, it's certainly a sleepy Utah town these days, but it was like a bustling big town.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there's statistics that there, you know, 500 kids in the town. So, in fact, in 1914, the school district built a new two-room schoolhouse in Echo because there just wasn't enough room in the church for the kids going to school there. You know, that's how many kids. And of course, that was all the railroad because, you know, the steam engines would come up from Ogden and it was so steep they would burn a whole load of coal and use up all the water. And so there was big, you know, coal loading station, water tanks, and yeah, everybody worked for, as they said, Uncle Pete, the Union Pacific.
Okay. And trains still use the line.
And when you come to the lecture, I always warn the people speaking that there will be a train coming through. And, of course, there's three railroad crossings in Echo, none of which have arms. So the train is, you know, legally required to blow its horn three times at each one. So it gets really loud really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, again, this lecture from Field Sketch to Photograph and Illustrative Journey of Echo Canyon happening this Saturday in Echo, Saturday at 2:30.
No,
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock, yes,
but come
early. And the other exhibit that we have right now, too, we've borrowed, it's an America 250 traveling exhibit, of course, and it's called Becoming the United States. So it talks about, you know, colonial America and the Declaration of 1776, and it features documents and images and maps and first-hand accounts from, you know, our nation's beginning. And, of course, back in 1776, Echo basically had a population of, they were called Kamumba Indians, Shoshone and Ute. It was right on the border of those two tribes, and so they intermarried. And of course, you know, like a lot of the snowbirds that live in Park City today, you know, would live up in Echo in the summer for the cooler weather and on the Weber River with the, you know, available food source and deer and elk. And then in the winter, they would travel down, you know, closer to the Great Salt Lake, you know, where it's obviously warm climate. Yeah.
So okay. And so those exhibits, they stayed up all summer?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So again, last chance
on Saturday.
Yeah. And they're really interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, just also, I know that you were one of the announcers, for the mucking and drilling competition for Miners Day.
I was, as
a Rotarian.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And who were you with there?
So Rory Murphy.
Okay.
You know, and his career was, you know, working for United Park City Mines. So, you know, he worked for Park City's last mining company when they were, you know, becoming a real estate development company. But they were, you know, wrapping up working with the EPA on a lot of the mines because all of them had consolidated into United Park. So a lot of land they were working on. And also he was the one that ran the Silver Mine Adventure when it was open. I think that was, 97 to 2000, yeah.
Yeah, so it was just a few short-lived. Years.
Short-lived, yes, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so... And I think, I mean, always a great turnout for it. I mean, people just and kind of really gives you an appreciation for the hard work and hard rock mining.
And, you know, and this year we had a bunch of young guys and really big. And you know, I think because, you know, the price of gold and silver has gained, I mean, I looked it up before the mucking and drilling and just was astounded that silver is $66 per ounce. I'm like, wow, it was $50. Or 45 when, you know, Naranda closed the Ontario back in the early 80s, you know, because that was the high point. And now it's even more than that. And gold is $4,500 an ounce. I mean, that's just astounding. Of course, the big mine in Park City that had the gold is the Mayflower. And of course, that's now covered by East Village. So I suspect even at $4,500 an ounce, there's more money to be made in high-end real estate.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, there is still, I mean, honestly, I mean, if it went up to $75, you know, an ounce for silver, would it ever start up?
There's a lot of work to get the mines back open again. I understand the Ontario, which is the shaft, you know, on the mine road, Marsac, that one, they can't get the they can't get past the 700-foot level because it's somewhat twisted, caved. So, yeah, there'd be a huge investment. But when you look back at, you know, Park City Ventures in Naranda, I think it was Park City Ventures, you know, that back in the 70s to get it open spent $3 million. And that included building a mill, which we have no operating mills in Park City either. So, you know, that would be another cost as well. But the Ontario, you know, is currently owned by Jordanelle Special Service District. So, you know, they're making money off the water, which I think most miners, you know, 150 years ago, they'd be rolling in their graves today because, you know, that was always the plague in the mines was the water. Now that's worth money too, yeah, especially this year.
Water and the real estate, yeah. Okay, any other comments?
No, thank you for having me. Yeah, and hope to see everybody this Saturday, 4 o'clock.
Sandra Morrison, again, is on the board of the Historic Echo Church. Thanks for your time. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Lauren Masuga is coming back from a surgically repaired ACL after missing the entire season last winter and the Milano Cortina Olympics. She's taking off soon, though, to get back on snow for the first time since last year. She joins me now in studio. Good morning.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I bet you're so excited to, like, get going here. So maybe just give us just a little bit of the history about what happened. It was about a year.
Coming up on 9 months, I think. So the day before the first Olympic qualifier of the season, I tore my ACL, medial lateral root meniscus, and had surgery December 9th. It's been a long road. I actually had to get a second surgery on March 9th to get a cyclops lesion removed. So it's been quite the journey, but excited to get back on snow here soon.
Yeah. So where and when are you going?
So I'll go down to Chile, Coralco, just south of Santiago. And I actually find out later today when I get to leave, I hope. I'm hoping. So I'm wishing the end of the month.
Okay, and that will be the first time on snow for you because we haven't had it since you've actually kind of repaired and healed from.
Yeah, that'll be the first time, and we go down for about a month.
Yeah, I saw a reel that you had posted of you on some kind of ski trainer, and so what, you had a video in front of you of some downhill course, or what was it?
Yeah, so they actually, like at the COE, the Center of Excellence, they have a ski simulator, and they can put up Beaver Creek. So when you see that video on my Instagram, I was kind of skiing Beaver Creek, which is really cool to get ready for the first race this year.
Yeah, it was so interesting to see. I mean, the movement is not a lot, right?
It's definitely, like, it really does mimic, like, being in the boots, I guess, like, for the knee and stuff, but it's a little different than skiing, but it's, like, the idea of, like, being in the boots and feeling the side-to-side in the knee is, like, huge for me.
Yeah, you were wearing a brace. Will you be wearing a brace when you get down to Chile, or?
Yeah, so the plan is to wear the brace for, like, at least the next year, like, in racing and everything. So it's going to be interesting figuring that out with our super tight race suits.
Yeah. Now, are you feeling like more of a ski racer rather than kind of an injured athlete going through rehab?
Oh, my gosh. Like, it's finally starting to feel, like, normal, like, everything's just like in the gym, it's more normal stuff. And I don't know, you kind of start putting on the ski boots and pulling out this boot bag and everything. Like, I don't know, that whole, all of this, like, building up to going skiing is, like, the best feeling.
Yeah. So how does the knee feel compared to, I guess, what you were expecting at this point?
Actually, it feels great. Mm-hmm. So like I mentioned, that second surgery, the first half of my rehab, like the first 3 months, I couldn't do anything just because it wasn't developing right. And so it had so much time to heal that it feels great. Everything I'm doing, like, it almost feels normal, which I'm, like, kind of grateful for. It sucked at the beginning, but now it's paying off.
I was going to say, I mean, are there areas where you're actually feeling maybe stronger than you were before?
Yeah, actually, it's been so fun. So we do a lot of testing at the COE, and a lot of it I am stronger than I was before. We did testing, actually, like the week before I fell, and a lot of the numbers are higher than then, which is really cool. So it gives me a lot of confidence going into this season.
Yeah. You're targeting the season opener at Beaver Creek in December. Are you pretty confident that that's going to happen?
Yeah, I feel like if I I mean, it's like, I don't want to get back until like I know I can get in the gate and be 100% ready to like go out and win. But it just kind of depends on the snow conditions and how much training I can get before. So my like hope is to be there. My plan is to be there, but I'm willing, like race day morning, if I'm not feeling like I'm going to win, I'm going to sit it out and wait for St. Moritz.
Sure, because I think a big part of the rehabilitation is, I mean, there's certainly all that physical part, but you've got kind of mental rehab to do as well, because that's terrifying when you go down at 70 miles an hour and
yeah.
get hurt.
Yeah, no, luckily for me, like I fell in GS, so it wasn't like downhill or super G what I'm normally doing. So I luck out that the mental block, I haven't gone on snow yet, but it shouldn't be as big. And we've actually been doing a lot of VR training. I have these VR goggles, and we have we take 360 cameras down the race courses, and so I have all of the World Cup races, so I can like train myself and ski. It feels like you're in the run, so I kind of like get a little like jump start on the season.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I guess how do you get to the point though where you feel like you can trust your body enough to do what you were doing?
Yeah, no, I feel like it's definitely like everything I do in the gym, like it just takes a second to get there again. You're like, oh, okay, like my body is figuring it out. And I feel like in skiing, it's just gonna take that like that little bit every time, like first time on snow, first time in GS, and then first time getting up to speed. It's just gonna take the like that little bit of time to just figure it out. And I'm confident that I can like do it. Like I can visualize myself skiing it and skiing it all fast. It's just gonna be with the getting the body back into it.
Yeah, before the injury, I believe you were ranked fourth in the world in downhill, sixth in Super G. Do you feel like you're returning as the same skier, or kind of has that experience maybe changed the way you approach ski racing?
I mean, this has definitely taught me so much, and I feel like I'm definitely going to be a different athlete from it. Like, I've learned, it's incredible what you learn through it. Don't get me wrong, terrible situation, terrible timing with the Olympics, but it is cool that like thinking about everything I can take into this season that'll make me a better athlete. And I feel like I just know what I need to do, like more, like I've trained myself and I believe I can do better this year through that.
Yeah, what are you looking for from yourself, I guess, in those first few races? I mean, is it just the confidence, the speed, the results, or just, you know, telling yourself or confirming for yourself, I can do this?
I feel like it will be a lot of like that, like mm-hmm. confirming and like being like, when I like, knowing in the gate, be like, okay, I'm here, like I can do this, like I can win. And it's not about, I guess, focusing on the results, but focusing on like how I approach that day and how my skiing is that day to be the best I can be and getting that to be consistent again. And I feel like it'll just be like, well, hopefully, like my plan is to start when I'm ready and feeling exactly like that. So
yeah, and maybe you could just talk a little bit about just the rehab that went into it. I know that I follow Michaela and Lindsey Vonn, and it's just, as well as you, but it just, it's the stuff they're doing, it's just, it's Herculean. Talk about how difficult that is, especially when you're pushing through pain.
Yeah, so like the first 3 months I was in the gym. I had PT twice a day, every day. I was going in on the weekends. I had Christmas off. Other than that, every other day I was in the gym. And most of the time it actually was pretty painful because it just wasn't that I had scar tissue developing, so it just kind of hurt every day. And so that was really, really hard, but like kept going because I knew what I want to be like world's best again. So I had to keep doing that. And actually after the second surgery, it got a lot easier, not as painful, but just as much work. So like some of the days I was in the gym from like 9 to 4, like you're just there all day, PT, workout, lunch, another workout and sauna. You're just, it's a whole thing. And it's crazy how much it adds. Like this is the most I've ever been in the gym. This is the most I've ever done. But it's paying off, which is nice. But it really shows you how much like a world-class athlete has to put in. It is a full-time job.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about that. I mean, just the resources that you have there at Center of Excellence. I mean, it's state-of-the-art, yeah?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, luckily, like, living right here, it's incredible. Like, so in the gym, like, they have the full PT set up in there, and they PTs are always in there. You have the full gym. They have sauna, like cold tubs. They have like basketball court. Like, obviously, I haven't been doing much basketball, but they actually set up a spring floor out in the gym area. Like, so we could do, like, it's just nice for the rehab athletes to have a softer surface in there. And they have trampolines. It's insane, everything in there. And every day we luck out, they serve the amazing lunches. We have a smoothie bar that Kodiak Cakes actually just redid. So it's really, really nice. And I mean, I'm pretty fortunate to be having all these resources while I went through all this, because it's definitely helped.
Yeah, I bet. So have you set yourself some goals for your comeback season?
Yeah. I mean, my goals are the same as they were last year. I mean, I don't think it has to change. I think the mindset changed a little bit, but the goals will stay the same. So I want to win a downhill. I've gone second in a downhill. I want to win a downhill. I want to go to World Champs. Want a podium there, and I want to go to Sun Valley with 500 points and start a GS again. And that's where I'll bring back my tech adventure. But I mean, those are big goals, and I know it's going to be hard, but I mean, it's better to, like, I want to go out there and do what I was doing before.
Yeah. So are world championships being held this season?
They are this year at Crans-Montana, Switzerland.
Wow. Okay. You know, you've of course become known for your bucket hats and your personality. I guess, did being away from Macy make you kind of appreciate that whole part of the sport, the travel, the teammates, the fun, the craziness?
Oh my gosh, you don't realize how much you miss it till you're not there. And it's so funny, everything you miss. Like, it's like little things where you're like, the team, when I talk to them and they're like, yeah, we're just like, all sitting around watching like someone get PT. They're all just sitting on the floor of the hotel room, and you're like, you know what, like, that is such a little thing you would have never thought about before, but you want to be there so bad. And all the like 8-hour car rides, traveling in a duffel from hotel to hotel all season, doesn't sound that flattering, but oh my gosh, you miss it. And it's just, I feel like it's gonna be so fun coming back and like doing all those things, being like, yeah, some of this isn't like the coolest thing ever, but I love doing it. I love every part of what I do. So I feel like it's just, this whole season is going to be just fun, like getting to do all that again.
Yeah. And of course, missing out on the Olympics this year. I mean, how much does 2030 kind of factor into your plans? Or is it just kind of need to take it day by day? Or?
Yeah, no, I think like I definitely think about, I mean, like the thing, everything you work for, like this is, but going to the Olympics, winning Olympic medal is one of the biggest things you can work for. And, well, I had that taken away from me this year. But I feel like that over the next 4 years, it gives me plenty of time to, like, refocus on myself, get the ski racing where I want it to be just in time for that. Like, I feel like I have plenty of time. And, I mean, luckily in ski racing, the like, I feel like 32 is, like, the prime age right now. So I'm only 24. I'm going to be in my prime by then.
Okay. Lauren, anything else you want to tell, share with us?
No, I guess I want to say Park City, like, during all this has been very supportive. And initially, it was crazy to feel the amount of love from everyone. So thank you, everybody. It means a lot.
Okay. Lauren Masuga, we're going to be rooting for you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Again, Laura Masugan, one of the members of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Alpine Team. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Beginning this school year, a collaboration between Park City School District and the Kimball Arts Center will be implemented at all four of Park City's elementary schools. In the studio with details, I have Kimball Arts Center Education Director Heather Staminoff, joined with Park City School District Executive Director of Teaching and Learning Amy Jenkins, and along with Fine Arts Coordinator and Eccles Center Director Brett Hughes. Good morning to all of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Heather, maybe you can just start and tell us a little bit about the impetus for all of this.
Yeah, I mean, the EVA program's been going for 13 years now, all four elementary schools. It started when there was a need for art in the schools. It was initially funded by the Park City Education Foundation and Kimball Arts Center. Kimball Arts Center played the role of writing lesson plans and supporting teachers, buying art supplies, because that's a big part of teaching art.
Yeah.
And Park City Education Foundation paid for those teachers in the schools. They fundraised, raised awareness around arts education. And so we had a really strong program for 13 years in the schools, and now we're excited to see it evolve. I feel like you asked the impetus. I feel like Brett was the impetus.
Okay, Brett. Yeah.
He had the idea.
And sort of, like, I put the rubber on the road, but there was conversations about just where we were in the 21st century, where we were in the One Park City model in the school district, and how to evolve all of our programming into that One Park City model. And, you know, the Education Foundation and Kimball Arts Center had done such a great job with this program to make sure our students had access to high-quality art education, and it was time for Park City School District to take it to the next level. And we're thrilled that Park City School District and the Board of Education prioritized this and made it integral in all four of our elementary schools, and took art from being something that students do to also being a vehicle to help them learn in multiple content areas.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that, but she mentioned EVA, that's Elementary Visual Arts.
Yeah.
And again, maybe Amy, you can take us a little back, a little bit of history here, because it's been at least 13 years, right, since the district then kind of pulled art classes out of the schools?
So what I would say is that it became a model at every school where the students were in a rotation to receive art, but it was not part of the regular specialist rotations where they see the PE teacher, music teacher, etc. And then I'd be remiss to not mention that Jeremy Ranch continued to do the volunteer, parent volunteer led masterpieces in art. When I was at Parley's Park as a teacher, we had masterpieces in art. And again, it was once a month that students got to go through that with parent volunteers. And again, I think it was at every step we've been trying to elevate what the students have been receiving. And again, just to piggyback off of what Brett and Heather have said, we also saw a need to look at integration models that were successful in the state and also could provide us some additional professional development and support. So Beverly Taylor Sorensen is well known in the state of Utah. So we will partner and continue to partner for professional development with them. We have a dance teacher at Parley's Park who is funded partially through Beverly Taylor Sorensen. And so we're kind of connecting all those pieces together. But yes, students have had art experiences and have had art education, and this is our opportunity to really help them engage with it through different content vehicles.
Yeah. Who is this Beverly Taylor Sorensen?
That's a great question, Brett.
So Beverly Taylor Sorensen has passed away. It's the Beverly Taylor Sorensen Arts Learning Program. Is an endowed arts program through the Utah State Board of Education that was developed to fund art teachers in any of the modalities, music, art, drama, dance, in schools that otherwise would not be able to afford them. And so it's an endowed fund through USBE from the state legislature to be able to pay for art teachers in those schools. We applied for funding as to be a part of this setup. The state did not authorize additional funding for this year, and we said, that's okay. We would like to take on the funding aspect, but can we still continue to engage in the professional development network? And BTS Arts said, absolutely. And so we engage in the BTS professional development network, as our dance teacher has been doing for years, our four visual arts teachers will do also. And that's great. They're a wonderful state partner. They've done a lot of research on the value of arts integration and the impact of arts integration. And then we can take that and elevate that to the next level with our local partners. Right, having Heather as a local resource to our teachers just elevates the professional development we can lean into, and then having the Park City Education Foundation as a funding local partner as well helps us again lean into just taking this excellent program and really just elevating it to the next level.
Okay, before we talk a little bit about how this works, maybe somebody can explain what is arts integration.
I'll take a stab at it. So arts integration is when our students are making a project. And with that project, they're bringing together an art form and knowledge from a content area. So it could be reading, writing, science, and math. And so through that project, they're engaging in learning, and they're also demonstrating that understanding. And we're meeting goals. As teachers, we're meeting our goals in art, but also in science, in math, or in writing or reading. So at the core of it is project-based learning. It's a hands-on experience.
Okay. Can you explain how this is going to work then, day-to-day in the classroom?
Yeah, absolutely. It's looking a little different in each classroom and in each school site. Each of these art educators is functioning in the specialist rotation right now, similar to PE, music, coding, library, stuff like that, for a portion of their schedule. and then they're developing relationships with classroom teachers to allow them to do side-by-side teaching in the with the classroom teacher, either in the traditional classroom or in the art studio, whatever makes the most sense for that specific lesson. And we're already seeing that happen. We heard just that there was a report from McPoland just yesterday of a side-by-side lesson happening at the fifth grade level with their art integration specialist supporting that classroom teacher to help students deepen their learning or another route to learning for the academic content they were covering in that classroom.
All right, and then, maybe, Amy, you could talk a little bit about just kind of the, I know there's lots of research that just shows how important art education is and the impacts it does have on student achievement.
Yeah, I think what it does is remove some of the barriers to traditional learning. And so students who maybe don't have the background knowledge to a rich, you know, art family life or something like that, they're able to look at imagery and make deeper connections to a story they're reading, for example. And they're able to look at an artist's rendition of something and draw out that meaning, just like we would ask them to draw out meaning from text. And so it runs as a parallel opportunity for students to just deepen their knowledge about things. And it, in a lot of ways, it levels the playing field because now they've got an outlet for expressing their understanding about something that's different than just speaking or different than writing. And so what we see is a lot more excitement around those activities and around those connections to what they're learning in the classroom, and also just a lot more opportunities for students to express through a different avenue. And so I believe it's a leveling of a playing field, similar to what we said when we put technology in everybody's hands when we went one-to-one in our school district with computers a number of years ago. This is just a new way to do that, or another way to do that. I don't know that it's new.
Right.
Yeah, but talk a little bit about just in terms of the what you're seeing in standardized testing and what you're seeing and just wanting to learn more.
Yeah, I think what we'll see first is that it shows up more in the students' ability to talk to each other about what they're learning in the classroom and how they express themselves about what the meaning is behind these art images and or the products that they're, you know, the art that they're producing. But then I also think we'll start to see it transfer into their writing. And a lot of their end of module tasks in our language arts units are some sort of cumulative writing project that they then produce. And so this is just another place for them to pull evidence of their understanding from. Mm-hmm. And then, like Heather mentioned, a project-based learning really is then to take it to that next place of sharing that with somebody. And in that sharing, the students have to express their understanding
as well.
The
reflection piece, I think, is also really important, where students are thinking about, what did I learn? How did I connect this to the writing, the reading that we're doing, this book that I just read, the C, whatever it is, and then having to share that with the teacher and having to write, or even just orally.
Yeah, and as somebody who was in the classroom, Amy, I mean, there, of course, are those kids that say, I can't draw, or, you know, I can't paint.
You know, what was fascinating is we asked during the interview process when we went out and recruited for these positions, we asked the teachers to create a lesson and in using our language arts module as the scaffold or the basis for it. And every single one of them addressed exactly that. How would you help a student who is having a hard time getting started with whatever the concept is?
I think that's the thing to remember. So we're still teaching art, right? And so we're scaffolding that. We're using our art standards. We're teaching how to draw. We're making students comfortable at the same time as we're supporting our classroom teachers with that content. So I think that we're not losing the art part. We're not losing that part where we're building that confidence. I mean, you have to teach that. You know, how do we hold a pencil? How do we move a pencil across a piece of paper? You
know? Exactly.
I think that's still part of the class, too. So.
Okay, so what's the Kimball Art Center's role, again, in all of this?
So we're here to support. It takes a lot of work to do this well. It takes a lot of collaboration with classroom teachers, a lot of conversations, understanding their curriculum, having time to read through, to do research, to think about, okay, what artists really connect with this in a very authentic way, you know? We're not just adding a drawing lesson to all of our regular curriculum, we're also thinking about, oh, could we use clay to do this? Could we use printmaking? Could, you know, what would be really meaningful? We want to share like kind of a quick lesson that our teachers are doing right now. That's a science standard, and they're using cellophane, colored cellophane, to show like how objects can be transparent or translucent. And that's a science standard, or opaque, you know. And so they're going to be making these sort of faux stained glass pieces. So a lot of that takes research and time. Our teachers are teaching all day. They have some prep time, but we're just here to kind of provide additional prep time. Also, just best practices. We're here to support with like resources, professional development. We want these teachers to feel enriched, both on like the art side and, you know, the educational side. Like, what are some strategies for reading, visual strategies for reading, all those things. So,
and the school district then is financing this.
So we hold all of the position licensed positions as part of our, you know, FTE allotments to each of the schools. So yes, and then the Ed Foundation, the Park City Education Foundation, is continuing to provide funds for the art supplies, because we want to make sure that those
quality
are
quality art supplies,
quality
really
professional art
part.
Supplies, and so to just augment the supply budgets at each of the schools. So they're a partnership. And then just like we provide professional development to our teachers around their curriculum and things like that, and we use professionals for that as well. We see the Kimball Art Center as being that local community professional in the art space to really help us have access to, as Heather mentioned, that time, the resources, the planning, the thought partnering, and things like that. So the art teachers, it's Brett had an experience with them a couple of Fridays ago where they all got together in the same room, maybe for the first time in person. And it, just the synergy in that room and the idea sharing and support of one another, I think this is a model that we can build a lot of things off of.
Yeah. I want to mention that parents can learn more about this. Tell me about the Art Night happening.
Come to Art Night. We celebrate arts education in Park City and all the things that Kimball Arts Center does. It's modeled after a school art night. So you walk in the door and you get homework assignment. Mm-hmm. And your homework is to walk around and learn about all the different programs. And EVA is one of our star programs. So we'll have examples of student work. We'll have, you know, photos of what's going on in the classroom. We'll be there to kind of share and talk more about, you know, if you have specific questions about what this looks like, how it's great for our kids.
Yeah, this is a night for 6 to 8:30 on
exactly,
October 8th,
yeah.
And this is for parents and adults as opposed
yes,
to
kids. Yes, for adults, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a great event for the Kimball Arts Center and all things Kimball Arts Center. And I can say there will be more opportunities for the community to engage in what's happening with EVA as the year goes on, right? Come to Kimball Arts Center Art Night and get an introduction to it, and then engage at parent-teacher conferences, engage at your school art nights as well. It's going to be a really cool program to follow this year.
And I think we'll be thrilled, too, to have, you know, our student art show again this year. Mm-hmm. The Wasatch Back Student Art Show will be in the spring.
Yeah,
I think it opens this year. We set the date for April 2nd, and that'll be, you know, and it's in this new form. It'll be great to see the work that's really connected to lessons by the students. So.
Okay, so we are going to continue to call it EVA.
EVA. Yes.
Yeah, it's just kind of a
Evolved. Okay. EVA E squared? I don't know.
Okay, anything else you wanted to mention that I may have missed?
No. Thank you so much for helping us spread the word of the good things that are happening.
I think lots of people are excited to have arts back. Yeah. That's Heather Stemenon, Brett Hughes, and Amy Jenkins. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Miners will kick off at the renovated Dozier Field for the first time Friday against Salem Hills. The school district says construction is ongoing, but renovations at the football field are complete enough to welcome spectators for the Miners' second home game of the season. The team's first official home game was played at the South Summit Field. Parking will be available in the main lot as well as at the church lot behind Dozier, but the front gate will be the only entrance into the stadium on Friday. During the game, only lower bleacher seating it will be available on the home side. Fans are encouraged to bring padded bleacher seats and cushions to sit on the concrete stands. A new concession stands won't be complete, but food trucks will be on site during the game. The school district also advises spectators there will be no open areas for kids to play before, during, or after the game, which is, I know, a big part of football nights. Visitors are asked to stay in designated walkways and seating areas. The Dozier Field renovations are part of a larger athletics upgrade that began last summer. Once complete, the football field will have a new track, turf, and concessions building. On the Treasure Mountain Junior High School footprint, the district is adding 2 soccer fields, 8 tennis courts, and a softball and baseball field. The district says batting cages and landscaping are going up, and the baseball field turf will be filled this week. Crews are putting finishing touches on the team rooms and parking lots as well. The district expects construction on the district's new athletic facilities to be completed by October. Park City's homecoming football game is scheduled for September 25th. Buying a home is out of reach for almost all renters in the Wasatch Back. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details on the state of the Utah housing market.
99% of Wasatch County renters cannot afford to buy a median-priced home. It's about the same in Summit County, where 97% of renters are priced out. That's according to a report on Utah's housing market published Wednesday by the University of Utah's Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute. Homeownership is less attainable for renters in the Wasatch Back than in the state as a whole. Overall, 91% of Utahns who rent can't afford the median home, according to data from the first quarter of 2026. Wasatch Back households must earn far more than the area median income to afford a 10% down payment and mortgage, according to the report. Summit County has the highest median household income statewide at $138,000. But the income required to buy the median home is more than triple that, $427,000. Wasatch County's median income is Utah's third highest, about $118,000. Annual earnings of more than $300,000 are required to buy a home. Sales prices in the two counties are the highest in Utah, with a median price of $2.2 million in Summit County and $1.2 million in Wasatch County for the first quarter of this year. To read the Gardner Institute's full report on the state of the state's housing, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.